Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on politics and language, personal abuse and the web. Now we've got three speakers, Tom Switzer, Shelley Gare and Bernard Keane, who will speak in that order. I'll introduce them briefly. They're all prominent in the public debate and we're very pleased that they could all make it here tonight. Caroline Obrington, who was going to come, unfortunately couldn't come, but we've got a great panel of three. So I'll introduce them. They're all well known to you. We're going to start with Tom Switzer. He's been many things, but in particular, I guess he's known as the former opinion page editor of The Australian and currently the editor of The Spectator Australia, which he edits and also writes for. Tom's making his first appearance at the Sydney Institute. Shelley Gare's making a return appearance. She's been here on a number of occasions. Shelley Gare is an author, a journalist and an editor. Her most recent book is Triumph of the Airheads, and she was here last year talking with Kate Jennings. And Dr. Bernard Keane from Crikey magazine. He has a PhD in history. He's worked in the Commonwealth Public Service in Canberra. He was for a while David McCormack on Crikey until he became what he always had been in the first place, which was Bernard Keane. I had a few rows with David and I've had a few rows with Bernard, but it's great to see him at the Sydney Institute, and he's a journalist I very much respect. So we'll lead off with Tom Switzer, then we go to Shelley Gare, and then to Bernard Keane on the topic of politics and language, political abuse and the web. Tom, you're welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Jared, and thank you to the Sydney Institute for having me here today. I must say it's a great honour to be speaking at the Sydney Institute because I'll never forget when I was a university student 20 years ago during the dark days of Paul Keating, and being a young conservative on campus, you were pretty isolated, particularly in those days. I see a few friends here from university. It was a bit like what Mitt Romney says, what it's like to be a conservative Republican in the liberal democratic state of Massachusetts. You're a cattle rancher at a vegetarian convention. You're pretty much isolated. So I often found refuge in Jared Henderson's columns. And a little known fact, Jared has been writing this column now, week in, week out now, for more than 20 years. Now, he's too modest to mention this, but that is a record. I can't think of any Australian or American who's written every week, and I've been an editor and a writer for nearly 15 years now, and that is a tough feat, especially even in the days of the blogosphere. So more power to you, Jared. I want to say just one thing about Jared's real treasure trove. Many of you are probably familiar with this Media Watch dog that is published every Friday, and I think it's a great source of information, and I think it represents what is great about the blogosphere. I just take last Friday's issue. He had a few pot shots at a few ABC journalists. One, Fran Kelly, who's an otherwise pretty good host on Radio National. But I just love the way a lot of these ABC journalists, objective, fair and balanced reporters and hosts of shows, are all too often now giving their opinions on the issues of the day. And we see that a lot on the Drum website as well as the Drum television show. I saw Mark Colvin, an otherwise very good producer of the PM program, give his opinion not so long ago, complaining about Tony Abbott opposing the flood levy. Now, why is an objective, fair and balanced host giving his opinions on such sensitive issues of the day? And I can't imagine someone like Andrew Olley or James Dibble doing anything like that in yesteryear. So, anyway, back to Fran Kelly. She came on and she said praise to Gough Whitlam for giving bipartisan support to Malcolm Fraser for the role he played in the Vietnamese refugee saga in the mid to late 1970s. And she said, good thing about Gough Whitlam is that he sang from the same song sheet as Malcolm Fraser on Boat People. Now, it's not true. And Gerard, quite rightly, through his evidence and archives, pointed out in great detail on this blog how it wasn't true, that far from giving bipartisan support to the then Liberal government, Gough Whitlam went out of his way to oppose Vietnamese refugees for various reasons, not least because he did not want to annoy Hanoi. Now, thanks to Gerard, a lot of people know that now. But in the old days, when Fran Kelly would get up and give her opinion on the issues, someone would go straight through the keeper. These days, it's now been corrected. And I think a regrettable byproduct of modern media proliferation has been its frequent lack of restraint and decency, especially on the web. David Broder rose above such rage as a veteran political reporter in Washington, which is one reason why so many people who knew him or read his writings or watched him on Sunday television have been mourning his death over the past week. David Broder, who addressed the Sydney Institute in 2005, was one of the best reporters and sober analysts of politics. Among other things, he took ideas and politics seriously. I like to say he's the Paul Kelly of American politics. David Broder was not one of those commentators on the right or left who say things merely to shock and score hits on the websites. Broder did not call anyone who disagreed with him a liar. He did not impugn motives. He answered arguments. In this, he was the model journalist. Now, one should not exaggerate the importance of journalists in our society, but I think that leading lights of the Fourth Estate do help set the tone for our political discourse. And David Broder, I think, set the right example. So given the subject matter this evening, perhaps it's not surprising that I should refer you to an article that Broder himself wrote in the Washington Post in September 2004. Now, during that year's election campaign, the US media world was engulfed in a major media scandal. CBS News and the veteran anchor and journalist Dan Rather produced a purported photocopy of an explosive 30-year-old order signed by a dead man to discredit George Bush's service in the Air National Guard. Once copies of the documents were made available on the internet, their authenticity was quickly called into question by numerous websites, not least one www.ratherbias.com. Now, much of this was based on the fact that the documents were proportionately printed and displayed other modern typographic conventions unavailable on military typewriters in the 1970s. The memos were revealed to be a forgery, and the source was a Texan with a grudge against George Bush and the National Guard. Instead of being treated with the deep distrust he deserved by the reporters to whom he offered his wares, the dodgy source was used liberally by CBS News to hurt Bush's re-election campaign. The scandal became known as Rathergate, and the producer, and indeed the host himself, Dan Rather, a veteran of mainstream media in America for more than four decades, eventually resigned. Now, David Broder blamed such shoddy journalistic ethics on whom? The bloggers. Quote, when the internet opened the doors to scores of so-called journalists who had no allegiance at all to the sceptical and self-disciplined ethic of professional news gathering, the bars were already down in many old-line media organisations. Broder goes on to say, that is how it happened to those old pros such as Dan Rather. They got caught up in this fevered atmosphere and let their standards slip. It's hard to overcome the sense that the professional practices and code of responsibility in journalism have suffered a body blow. That was David Broder at the heat of the Rathergate scandal in 2004. Now, is this really true? Should the internet, or blogosphere, be blamed for the proliferation of declining journalistic standards? Do bloggers and web writers lack, quote, as Broder put it, the sceptical and self-disciplined ethic of professional news gathering that all too often marked the mainstream media for years? Now, I think that David Broder, as you might suspect, makes some very fair points. But I also think he understates his case, and maybe actually, sorry, overstates his case in the sense that he downplays some of the good things that blogs do. I think that all things considered, the rise of the web, and talk radio for that matter, has been a welcome change in the Australian and indeed the American public debate. Here are just three of them. First, let's look at some history. Like many journalists, Broder failed to put the rise of the blogosphere in its proper historical context, perhaps because he was a creature of that culture for so many years. Now, it's hard to convey today what it was like 50 years ago in both Australia and the United States. There were obviously no radio talkback programs. There were no websites or blogs. There were no opinion pages, such as The Australian, which Jared mentioned I used to edit. And there's no real opinion magazine such as The Spectator, which I now edit today. There was Quadrant, but that was pretty much a minority. Newspapers, especially in Australia, were pretty much dull and parochial. And the only opinion in those days was the newspaper's leader or editorial, sometimes published off the front page. And for decades in both the United States and Australia, media sophisticates were able to control the political debate by kicking in the one direction, a bit like the Rockettes. But of course, since the rise of things like the blogosphere and talkback radio, the cultural landscape is no longer as flat and unvaried as the proverbial Australian sheep station. Second, that diversity of opinion on the airwaves and in the blogosphere means that a media is more representative of the nation. More diversity, more debate, more voices. The internet's most powerful effect has been to expand vastly the range of opinion, and I would argue a lot of centre-right opinion, at virtually everyone's fingerprints. It helps break up the traditional cultural gatekeeper power to determine what's important and the range of acceptable opinion. Now, in the old days, of course, you'd write a letter to the newspaper and it would take days to get published if it ever was. And then it was sliced and diced by cultural gatekeepers who often thought of conservatism as some sort of mental affliction. But these days, of course, you can just call up the open line on Talkback Radio and give your say, or go to a blogosphere and give your feedback and comments. And third, this new diversity of opinion means greater scrutiny and accountability of virtually everything, from politicians to journalists themselves. Now, I've already discussed the Dan Rather case in 2004. That was, in many respects, a media watershed, but there are other examples to point to as well. Several years ago, the Republican Senator Trent Lott made some comments that seemed to praise segregation at Strom Thurmond's 100th birthday party. Many of you may remember Strom Thurmond was a long-time Dixiecrat, then he became a Democrat, then a Republican. It was, relatively speaking, a low-key event, but the bloggers got the news and they broke the story. The New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times didn't get it. The bloggers broke it. And the result? Lott was forced into a humiliating backflip and he was forced to resign as the Senate Majority Leader. The internet's also made media bias harder to pull off. According to my friend Brian Anderson in City Journal, it was a blogosphere's army of ombudsmen that revealed Enron-bashing Paul Krugman, who's a New York Times columnist, and his former ties to who? Enron. It was the blogosphere's army of ombudsmen that revealed how the New York Times twisted its polls to further its liberal agenda. And it was the blogosphere's army of ombudsmen that showed the many outrageous fabrications of the journalist Jason Blair, who was hired and then defended consistently by Times management because of affirmative action. He was African American. And that saga culminated in the resignation of the New York Times editor, Howell Raines. Now, all of this is true, and I think it's a good thing. However, having said all of this, there is undoubtedly a downside to the blogosphere. And I think one would be very unwise to play down David Broder's broader concerns about slipping standards in the media world. And like talkback radio, the blogosphere can be flippant and provocative and at times downright rude and angry. Some case studies, just quickly. The ABC Drum. Back in October, you may recall that extraordinary personal attack which depicted the South Australian MP Christopher Pyne as the most loathed man in Australia. The author, Mariac Hardy, hoped Mr. Pyne would, quote, get attacked by a large and libidinous dog. The article was subsequently pulled from the site, but the episode raised legitimate concerns about why such an outrageous piece of commentary, and I could go on with more quotes, was put up there in the first place. Comment sections of blogs. I occasionally write for this website called The Drum, the ABC Drum. One of my big issues is climate change, specifically the perils of trying to reach any kind of international consensus on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And it's generally speaking a fairly academic argument, but the comments will be overwhelmingly hostile and downright irrational, so much so that people like me are somehow in the pocket of big oil or big coal. And they completely ignore the late liberal anti-communist Sidney Hook's wise rule for polemics. Before you impugn someone's motives, even when they may be legitimately impugned, first answer their arguments. And you don't get a lot of that on the blog. Another downside is responsibility or lack thereof. And you may know of WikiLeaks and the role that's getting in the media at the moment. It's received a great deal of praise for revealing US government secrets. But with power comes responsibility. Where was the responsibility in outing the dozens of Afghan civilians in the document dump as US military informants? Now, their lives, as well as those of their families, have been put at the terrible risk of Taliban reprisal. Note that when the New York Times and the Guardian reprinted the WikiLeaks files, they specifically took out the names of those people mentioned. Why? Because lives could be in danger. The New York Times were responsible, WikiLeaks was not. And finally, in the immediate aftermath of the assassination of Arizona Congressman Gabby Giffords, this was just a few months ago in Tucson, left-wing bloggers led by Daily Kos Online smeared conservatives from Sarah Palin to so-called shock jocks to right-wing bloggers by suggesting they incited the shooting. And yet there was no basis whatsoever for suggesting that these people caused the shooting of Giffords. The shooter was, if anything, of the left, did not listen to talkback radio, had no connection to Palin or the Tea Party, and if anything, he was psychologically unhinged. And this prompted Time magazine to comment, quote, "Informed and insightful political commentary has never been more abundant and easily available thanks to the internet, yet the voices of the sensationalists are louder than ever." And that's why I'm sitting on the fence in this debate, because I think that all things considered, the blogosphere is a good thing because there's more diversity, there's more accountability, there's more scrutiny, but it is also a source of some flippant and provocative and downright angry commentary as well. But in a democracy, I would prefer to have the blogosphere than not.
Thank you very much. You know what W.C. Fields used to say about never try to share a stage with an animal or a child. I will remember in future to never try to share a stage with someone who's as good a speaker as Tom Switzer. Thank you, Jared and Anne, for asking me to come along tonight, and thank you to the audience for coming along. I've actually only written 3 blogs, but I have been writing a column from various newspapers since the late 90s, and I also was an early adapter for the internet and for the web. I paid myself to go to the to a conference in Harvard on the internet in 1996. This was when I was working at News Limited, which was a bit of a problem, because when I came back, neither Lachlan Murdoch nor Rupert Murdoch believed in the internet. So that was one investment in my career that went down the drain. But what had fascinated me about the internet and the web was, as a journalist, was always limited by how many pictures, how many words you can use, and also the fact, you know, there's no audio, was to think that you could have these sites which would do all these 3 things. That's how I was imagining the future. I didn't know that we were going to end up where we are now, in a very, very, very different kind of world. I want to step back a little bit. I didn't even realise we were supposed to be taking sides in this debate. I wanted, instead of zeroing in on blogs and blogging and the good and the bad, I actually want to look at the bigger picture, which I reckon has brought us to where we are. I may be a little bit darker than Tom. I certainly agree with Tom on what it's done for journalism and the good things it's done. But there are some big changes in our society and our culture as a result of what's going on. I'd say that where we are right now is in a state of confusion, irritation, uncertainty, and deep unease. A state where people are easily angered by others and where to disagree with somebody is the equivalent of a medieval knight throwing down his gauntlet. In times like these, any tactics seem approved. Hence we saw what we saw last night with the Prime Minister on Q&A, and what we do so often see on Q&A. I don't know how many of you saw that programme, but I was stumped. I mean, does anyone seriously think that this is the way to treat a Prime Minister? Does anyone seriously think that this had anything to do with devising the best policies for our country's future? So how do we get to here? Here's one theory. I read the other day that in 1844, when Samuel Morse sent the first public long-distance telegraph message from Washington to Baltimore, he and his friends were so awestruck by the experience that the line in the telegraph was, "What has God wrought?" Physiologists were just as awed. They compared the transmitters of the electrical telegraph to human nerve endings. They thought of the messages as human thoughts, and they decided that the entire telegraph network was a new kind of central nervous system. Of course, it wasn't. It just was a way of sending messages. And unless humans did things at either end and along the way, the messages didn't get sent or didn't get read. I don't know what it is about us humans. We are so ready to take the miracle of the human being for granted. We don't cherish young brains. We don't nurture every child on earth so it grows up fully capable of using all its human abilities and talents. But we are ready to marvel with dropped jaws about anything that smacks of technology and complex theory, particularly if lots of people, or some people, canny people, are making piles of money out of it. I found the tale of Samuel Morse and the physiologists in a 2009 book called Cyberbia by British social forecaster James Harkin. And the book's subtitle is "The Dangerous Idea That's Changing How We Live and Who We Are." He writes, "Much of the rapturous confusion between man and electrical machine explains the phantoms that have grown up around our new communications technology. The internet and the web are amazing inventions which have changed our lives dramatically, made many things easier, many other things possible for the first time. But there's so much rapture surrounding the internet, and in particular, the global communication and swapping of information on the web, that, shades of Samuel Morse and co, we are falling to our knees in front of this technological breakthrough as if it has outstripped the human beings who created it." Now, this is a dicey time for journalists, and unfortunately, during my working life, I forgot to learn how to do anything else except journalism. And so now I have a keen and necessary interest in what the internet is doing to the art of communication, to storytelling, to research and to commentary. I want to keep that baby in the bathwater. Whenever I'm asked if I tweet, I say no, and then I try to explain that I like to have at least some time in the day away from my computer and email when I can think, daydream, ponder, use my imagination, blank out, and just generally catch up with what my brain's already processing. We all know about getting great ideas in the shower, cracking problems in the shower. We do that because we just let our brains go. Our brains can kick into top gear, so we're not trying to ride them the whole time. Anyhow, when I admit this to people that I do who do tweet, it's as if I'm admitting something shameful, that yes, I'm human. I like this old-fashioned thing I call a body and a brain. I'm in awe of my synapses and neural pathways. I wish to grow more of them, and I treat them with respect. And much as I'm grateful to the internet and web for where they have helped me, especially email, research, checking, and especially having my stories and now my blog up online so my writing can be read around the world by people who have never even visited Australia, I'm wary of the disjuncts I keep seeing opening up around me like chasms. I'm especially wary of the way I see us humans discounting our own innate abilities in order to prostrate ourselves in front of something which, in many cases, is actively working against those abilities. When I switched on to Q&A last night on the ABC to watch Julia Gillard, I thought for a few blessed minutes, thank goodness, no Twitter feed. Obviously, I thought, the powers that be, either at the ABC or in the PM's office, had decreed that the PM would be able to speak and answer questions without a stream of ticker tape commentary underneath her face. But it was not to be. Either the tweeters were a little awed, or perhaps the ABC's moderators were being super cautious, but it took a minute or so before the tweets actually started. And here they are. This is the first. "The red fox meets the silver fox. Tonight's Q&A is going to be awesome. And I've got my fanciest pyjamas on for Julia." There are a couple of pertinent comments about the carbon tax, but mostly the tweets fell into either the jokey camp or they told us how we should be feeling. Commentator Leslie Canold, or someone with that handle, tweeted, informing me that Q&A is no longer a viewing choice, it is a civic duty. And at the very end, Laurie Oakes, or again, someone with the same name as the Nine pundit, tweeted, "Agree with her or not, this is a pretty impressive performance. Thanks, Leslie and Laurie. I guess maybe I wouldn't have thought that. It wouldn't have made this kind of thing just makes me want to clutch my head. I mean, what's it driven by? Is it driven by ego, partisanship? Why did those two people with such high public profiles, why did they have to tweet? Anyhow, the Twitter feed on Q&A demonstrates to me the worst of what our amazing new world of information and interactive communication, of commentary and blogging is all about. The Twitter feed is mostly facile and frivolous. It too often demonstrates a lack of respect for both the people on the panel and the viewing audience's intelligence. It also displays the kind of rampant narcissism that you just know is bellowing, "Hey, look, that's my tweet up there on national TV." But the main thing about that Twitter feed is it's not needed. And yet, I admit, the program would be very different without it. For a start, it would require more concentration. I mean, when that Twitter feed did start, just for a few minutes, even I thought, oh, you have to concentrate. I mean, it's just going to be Julia. It's just going to be the questions. So the tweets are the equivalent of distracting sugar cubes to make the medicine go down. In the event of the panelists getting serious or too serious, well, the ABC producers can always rely on the tweets to supply some light relief. Now, this kind of stuff is addictive. We get used to it, and then we miss it when it isn't there. When I started my blog for the Sydney Institute late last year, a friend wrote in saying that I would get more readers if the site allowed comments. He's probably right. Although I have to say, Jeremy, and I'm really grateful you don't have a comments policy. It can feel odd to read opinion pieces and blogs, even features, online when they don't have a string of comments at the end. Even I notice that when I'm engrossed. But here's the thing, what I also notice is that without those pages of comments rattling away, ranging from invective to smartass to occasionally thoughtful to plain off the air, I'm left in peace to think about the actual article, to work out if the writer knows what they're talking about, to think about it, to question it, to absorb it, to go further with it. The problem with the internet, with blogging, tweeting, commenting, is not those things in isolation. It's their effect on the other things that we do. Every revolution, whether it's the French, Russian, or now technological, is pushed along by fanatics who claim that the revolution signifies there is now a whole new world order, that all the things that used to matter no longer do, and that anyone who doesn't believe this and understand this is doomed. Doomed to live in the past, doomed not to be part of a bright new future that promises opportunity, excitement, and a soft feathered bed forever. And this very act of chucking away all that has mattered in the past, including codes of conduct and long-held beliefs, wisdom in fact, ends up subverting the very aims of the original revolution. Bonjour, Monsieur Robespierre. Welcome, Comrade Stalin. With a technological revolution here, we are all over again being persuaded, nudged, pushed, bullied into believing we need to turn our back on the past totally. I'm often exhausted after I read the Australian's media section on Monday because it's numerous breathless stories about the latest internet breakthrough, latest gadget, latest techo, bizzo, wizzo web deal. The Murdochs have changed the tune, obviously, since 1996. Then I realise I have the rest of the newspaper in my hands and I can read it. And then that the newspaper only works because it carries stories about the world and human beings. And it needs human beings to write those stories. And human beings who know how to spell, use grammar, and communicate stories and opinion clearly and vividly, and check their facts. The last weekend, Weekend Australian, I read an extract from Neil Ferguson's new book, Civilization, the West and the Rest. His argument is that the rise of the West is the preeminent historical phenomenon of the second half of the second millennium after Christ. But Western civilization appears to have lost confidence in itself. And he says, the grand narrative of Western ascent has fallen out of fashion. The greatest threat to Western civilization, he says, is our own faint-heartedness and the historical ignorance that fuels that. The piece made me go away and think, and maybe get up and dig out other books on my bookshelf, in which other writers have questioned where Western civilization is heading. I discussed it with another friend. And at no stage did I wish that instead of reading Ferguson's extract in the newspaper, in the hard copy, that I had instead read it online with 346 or so attached disputatious comments. Just as the Twitter feed on Q&A distracts the audience and undermines what is being said simply by being distracting, online comments all too often dwarf and overshadow the original article, often making it seemingly redundant or irrelevant, as posters rush to use it simply as a convenient leaping-off point for their own arguments. read all the comments on a blog that has dealt with something controversial, and you'll mostly end up with long versions of he says, she says, he says, she says, and your brain, it turns to sludge. And in fact, because of tonight, I did check out an interview with Neil Ferguson on The Guardian's website, and that attracted 125 comments. And the first one was a criticism, the second told the first to bone up, and the third wrote, a final flatulent fanfare from a world order that is collapsing before our eyes, predictable, boring, wrong. The fourth gave Ferguson a boot. The fifth gave him reserved praise, but told him how he could improve the ending of his other book, The Ascent of Money. By now, it's only five comments. I'm cross-eyed. I looked through the other 121 comments, and ironically, most bore out Neil Ferguson's argument. If Western civilization is relying on this lot to save it or even defend it, God help it. Earlier I mentioned disjuncts. By that I meant the disjunct between what we are told about the internet and what is actually happening. For instance, the web is supposed to be about communication, but it is actually devaluing communication because there are simply too many voices demanding to be heard and not enough thought going into what is being communicated, as things are pasted willy-nilly without the benefit of editors or filters. It is supposed to be about sharing knowledge, and yet the web, as it exists so often today, challenges the very idea that there is a hierarchy of knowledge and that one person may have a greater right to express themselves on a subject than another. Everything is flattened to the status of, quote, that person's opinion, end quote, no matter how much or how little research and analysis has actually been done. The web, the internet, is supposed to be about the world having a conversation. A true conversation requires listening. It's supposed to be about efficiency and saving time. How many hours do we all lose each week reading blogs, emails, internet sites, drafting comments, posting comments? And how much of that activity achieves anything? When Jonathan Safran Foer's book Eating Animals came out in 2009, I was impressed by the thousands of comments that it attracted on the Huffington Post website. In fact, I was trying to get people to take an interest in the book here, and I kept pointing out to editors, look, thousands of comments over there. People over here just weren't that interested in that book, which is a real shame because it's a compelling indictment of factory farming. But since then, I thought, what if instead of commenting, those people had instead bestirred themselves to write original letters, that is, not form letters, to their local congressman or woman, telling him or her about the book and quoting its arguments and making their own arguments. It would have been very nice for Mr. Furr's sales, of course, but I bet it would have helped making things a hell of a lot nicer for chickens, pigs and cows and all that commentary. Do we blog and comment to make a difference? Or just to keep in with our mates and reassure ourselves, is anyone telling? The web is supposed to be about community and collaboration, according to Time magazine. But even the Australian's redoubtable columnist, Emma Jane, that is Emma Tom, as she used to be, cracked the week before last, tired of internet venom. She wrote, and it's a very good piece, dig it out if you can, what used to be called hate speech is now a run-of-the-mill online article comment section. By the way, that article appeared on the Punch website and attracted 78 comments, most of which were jeering. You just can't take it now. You took it, boots on the other foot now. On that note, let me read you out the guidelines for the commentary from the political group blog Lavatus Prodeo. Please keep discussion civilised. And then it gives a precise list of unacceptable behaviour. But Andrew Bolt still gets called a racist, lying bigot. Miranda Devine tells me she no longer uses that delightful device of writing hyperbole because it gets willfully quoted out of context. Whenever there are huge crowds and confusion, as there are on the internet and on the web, and whenever there is uncertainty, as there is now, it's the bullying voices that often triumph in the end. As every dictator knows, human beings can be horrible. It's indeed the very trait that every dictator depends upon. Whether it was Hitler's regime or the East German regime policed by the Stasi, they survived because of huge networks of informers ready to dob in anyone if it was to their own advantage or safety. People, if encouraged and given license, will do horrible things to other human beings. The more we tolerate the vitriol and verbal violence on the net, the more we say to people that this behaviour is okay, and the more this behaviour we will see. As I said, any tactic becomes permissible. It is even worse when we seem to be saying that such behaviour is hip, cool, and the new way. It's not. There's a very easy solution to all this. Just believe that humans are mightier than machines. believes that revolutions are part of human progress, but yes, keep the baby in the bathwater. Harness the internet and the web just as we've harnessed or should have harnessed every other breakthrough invention. The idea is that the web should take us further towards civilization, not backwards. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Jared, and thank you, Jared and Anne, for the invitation tonight. I've got the curse of the third speaker, which means all my really good points have already been made by, mainly by Tom, a couple by Shelley as well. I'll be echoing Tom quite a bit, I suspect. I'd like to begin at the obvious starting point for a discussion about political abuse in the internet, and that's the weavers of early modern England. Weavers played an important role, some say crucial role, in the spread of Protestantism in 16th century England for several reasons. The industry operated in towns along key trading routes, meaning weavers were regularly exposed to news, new books and new ideas, and it was a highly literate profession, conducive to debate and argument. The 17th century Puritan divine Richard Baxter wrote, "I have known many in the long loom that can set their sermon notes or a good book before them and read and discourse together for mutual edification while they work." Read and discourse together. It was the connectedness of weaving that made it a perfect vector for the bibliocentrism and the message of personal salvation of Protestantism. Later in the 17th century, for political radicalism as well. Now, scroll forward a couple of hundred years and we see another wave of connectedness that had enormous political implications. As industrialisation drove the development of trade unions, connecting together otherwise powerless individuals, not just to establish basic protections for wages and conditions and undertake collective bargaining, but eventually to try and drive wider social and economic change at a national and, even if only by way of ambition, at an international level. These ways of connectedness were driven by, but also limited by, the communications platforms available at the time, the printing press, and horseback communication, until well into the 19th century, and then telegraphy, railways, and the beginnings of mass media. The internet is another wave of interconnectedness, the biggest one of all. It's different in degree, but not in kind, from what's gone before, but the degree is very, very big. The internet connects completely, globally. Until the late 20th century, communities were limited by geography. People could communicate across the world, but not in networks. They were connected, but not interconnected, in the way that they were with their families, their neighbours, or their work colleagues. And I think this interconnectedness is what's important, not the technology or the platforms. It was what the weavers did with their Bibles and their tracts that was important, not the printing press or the trade routes. It was what radicalised class-conscious workers did as unionists that was important, not printing presses or railways. And it's not Facebook or Twitter that's important. It's what people use them for. So, you're probably all wondering what this has to do with political abuse and the web. Well, before the internet, political debate relied on what I call, and I'm going to elaborate on some of the things that Tom talked about here, what I call, to continue the religious theme, the sacerdotal concept of journalism. Editors and journalists mediated, like priests, between politicians and mass audiences, deciding what to tell them and framing how issues were debated. Sometimes this was in cooperation with politicians, and other times it very much wasn't. But the mainstream media acted, to use another metaphor, and I'm picking up on Tom's word here, as gatekeepers of political debate. And the medium, in this case, very closely mirrored the message. The media had this role because, courtesy of the high cost of printing and distribution systems and of broadcast infrastructure, and not to mention the politically controlled licensing of broadcasters, media access was limited to very, very few people. So political debate was thus a broadcast model. Audiences could participate only by tuning in and watching the debate, the parameters of which were framed by editors and producers and journalists. The only debates in which audiences could genuinely participate were via talkback radio and letters to the editor, and both were controlled by the mainstream media. Interconnectedness has changed this debate fundamentally. The broadcast model is breaking down. Now the mainstream media is only part of the debate, much of which now occurs between people, unmediated by anyone else, online. The audience is much more in control of the debate, because they're now talking amongst themselves rather than passively watching the debate. So the debate is therefore very different from that controlled by the mainstream media. It's coarser, it's snarkier, it's angrier. is far less quality control. But often it's far more informed on specialist issues than generalist journalists are. It's less likely to be caught up in the sort of groupthink that frequently pervades press gallery political coverage. And above all, it's infinitely more democratic. It's also far more fragmented, and I'll talk about this a bit more in a moment. But for generations, there were three media for political debate: print, TV and radio. Now there are a huge number of platforms in addition to the traditional three. There are media websites and there are comment sections, as Shelley talked about, under articles. There are mainstream media blogs. There are independent media sites like Crikey. There's Twitter and Facebook. Vast amounts of political debate goes on Facebook, unobserved, except by the participants. There are blogs, some with thousands of readers. There are discussion boards. Political debate often breaks out on discussion boards that have nothing to do with politics. I might be confessing something here, but I often self-Google, and I'll find my articles cut and pasted into a footy blog. And people are arguing over politics on a footy blog. And there are activist networks like the egregious and apparently omnipotent GetUp. All that's just for domestic politics. Political debate is now a spectrum of conversations on different platforms, each with different rules, different tones, different audiences, and different expectations. Now, much of this was a debate that was always occurring outside the reach of the mainstream media. It occurred in homes and pubs, over back fences, in workplaces. But now it occupies the same space that the media occupies, or in many ways shares much of that space. And it's no longer limited by geography. It occurs on a regional, a national, and international scale, between strangers, among groups who would not otherwise have any connection, and anyone can participate. So has interconnectedness ushered in a cyber utopia of high quality political debate? Well, of course not. When you allow people to connect up, well, you get people who no one would like to see connected up. Not just pedophiles and terrorists and organised crime, but conspiracy theorists for which the internet is the ideal breeding ground. 9/11 truthers, Holocaust deniers, religious zealots, right-wing crazies, left-wing lunatics. The internet is a cyber group hug for them. But still, if you value free speech, then that should be a price that you're willing to pay. But there are two aspects of this new debate in an interconnected world that I do think bear consideration. One is that we're all now much better at ad hominem attacks than we used to be. Now, I don't mean this as a matter of style. It's just that it's now very, very easy to know who your interlocutor is in any debate. If you don't know who they are, you can Google them. And much of what they have written, in many cases, everything they've ever written, is just a click away, enabling you to profile your opponent and explain their position in terms of their ideology or who they work for, who they support politically, what they said on unrelated issues. It seems to me that we're all just guilty of using this to play the person and not the ball much more than we might have used to when we had to grapple with someone's ideas rather than explaining them away with reference to who they are and what they said on other occasions. Small example from Crikey. Whenever I write, which not very often, on tobacco, I find myself adopting a similar position to the IPA. And Crikey's commenters react to that by complaining that the IPA takes money from tobacco companies. Now, I don't know whether the IPA does or not, or whether they used to in the past. It's relevant, but they will mention that as though that gets you off the hook for having to debate them, for having to show where their logic's flawed or show where their evidence is wrong. It's as if, well, you took money from tobacco, I can disregard what you have to say. And, of course, that's not the case at all. The other issue is what I've called ghettos of agreement or echo chambers, a term that conservative critics of social media have picked up. This is a product of the greater control that people now have over political debate. Political debate can now be personalised just like you personalise your iPod playlist, compared to the old days when what you listened to was dictated by radio producers. And Twitter's the ideal symbol of this. In selecting whom you follow, you can entirely control what news and commentary you see, particularly if, like many of us, you've actually given up on using newspaper websites altogether. What we've lost from the broadcast model of political debate is that single mass participation space that the media used to provide when it could aggregate all eyeballs across a small number of channels and a handful of newspaper mastheads. Empowering individuals is always good, but I think we're the poorer for having fragmented what was once a unitary space in which big public policy could be debated. You can now ensure that you are in no danger of being exposed to challenging or uncomfortable ideas unless you actually want that. That's not to say that all the negatives are on the side of the internet. It's plain that there is a deep resentment in parts of the mainstream media about how it no longer controls political debate. This isn't surprising. The last 10 years have seen a succession of gatekeepers unhappy that the internet is ruining their business model. Studio executives unhappy about downloading. Media moguls unhappy about content aggregation. Retailers unhappy about e-commerce. Politicians unhappy about WikiLeaks. Even lawyers unhappy about jurors using Google. Go further back, not too far back, you'll find captains of industry unhappy about trade unions and wanting to ban them. And Anglican clerics, like their Catholic predecessors, were unhappy about congregations discussing religion amongst themselves without the guidance of priests and bishops. For many journalists and editors, the fact that they no longer control the debate is hard to stomach. This was best summed up by a tweet from a press gallery journalist during the 2010 election campaign, who reacted angrily to criticism from bloggers of coverage of the Augur report by demanding, just let the professionals do their job. This criticism and the criticism from other press gallery journalists of what they call the parasites and the armchair critics over online criticism of their campaign coverage, I think perfectly sums this up. It takes other forms as well. The Australian, amongst its many wars, is engaged in a war, I think, on new media. It outed and attacked a blogger who'd been critical of News Limited. Its editor threatened to sue an academic over tweets. Its media editor threatened to report another academic to police over a tweet. And extraordinarily, an editorial on the tragedy of the Queensland floods was used to lash out at social media. The Fairfax Press, I think, may be even worse. Fairfax specialises in what I've started calling gatekeeper porn, running stories on the evils of the internet so frequently and regularly that there seems to be an editorial directive to gather any possible connection between Facebook and something bad happening somewhere in the world and run it prominently. And in a fascinating example of not getting the internet, which is a famous phrase, famous criticism of the mainstream media that's been around for a long time, last year Fairfax, unlike every other newspaper in the world running WikiLeaks cables, refused to put online the cables that it ran stories on, and actually admitted that its basis for preventing us from making up our own minds about the cables was fear of other outlets covering the cables better than it had. But to me, this resentment confuses the changing nature of political debate with the changing business model of news media. Mainstream media journalists and editors and executives are plainly right to be concerned about the threat of new media to traditional media business models. And so should the rest of us, given no one's yet worked out where quality mass audience journalism is going to come from in a world of online revenues. But that's a different issue to the changed nature of political debate, in which the mainstream media now only plays a part, albeit an important one, rather than wholly controlling it. In that space, the media can continue to play the role for which we value it most highly, its contribution to a civil society and to an informed electorate. But it will simply do so as part of a wider conversation. We may no longer be discussing scripture over looms, but interconnectedness is again driving major socioeconomic change. And it has a long way to go yet, despite the best efforts of Middle Eastern dictators. It has given us a new form of political debate, one that we need to adjust to. Along the way, yes, we have lost some of the good parts of the old media-controlled debate, but I think in exchange for a fundamentally more democratic one. Thank you.
So many thanks to our three speakers. We've got to no later than 7 o'clock, so we've probably got about half an hour for question and discussion, which is plenty of time. Before we start, I should say thanks to Clayton Yunt for the use of this great facility this evening. And so we come to question and discussion. I'll probably get three speakers just to stand up near the microphone so we don't have to switch around. Anyone want to lead off?
I just wonder if there's any hope of getting bias-free discussions or balanced discussions on the ABC. I found years ago, the more you're pushing in one direction, the more I go in the other direction. And I'm getting to a stage where I don't believe a thing that the ABC says, and I don't see why my money has to go to the Spectator, which I do.
Okay.
Okay. Other people get it all on my taxpayers' money for free.
We don't have anyone here from the ABC, so does anyone want to handle that? Tom does.
Okay. Look, I've written many articles over the years, very critical of the ABC for what I see as a soft left bias in some of its news and editorial output. But I think the ABC, to be fair, has improved significantly over the last 10 to 20 years. I'm assuming you like your politics fairly conservative, which is there's nothing wrong with that. But crikey, 10, 20 years ago, no one in their wildest dreams could imagine waking up on a Sunday morning and seeing Andrew Bolt on the Insiders program with Barry Cassidy, or Jared Henderson on the ABC's Insiders program, or Tim Blair. Now, I think that's changed for the better. You might think it's very marginal change, but I think in the grand scheme of things, that suggests that the ABC has improved. I also think that as good a journalist as Kerry O'Brien was, I think he was biased, and I think that the two people who have replaced him in Lee Sales and Chris Ullman on 7:30 are very fair and very balanced, and that's been particularly evident over the last week and a half. So I think they are making some progress.
So we go right over there. Yeah.
I think the internet's been wonderful for individuals. It's freed us up and it's given a lot of people a voice that they wouldn't have been heard before. But it's also got very big, very confusing, and it's full of a lot of rubbish. And it seems to me that it's been bad for professionals. There are professional journalists like Shelley and others around who can't really make much of a living out of it anymore. Do you see a day coming when we will invent a new thing called the editor? And will actually produce high quality online reading for people of the mainstream to once again, you know, go to somewhere like the newspaper used to be and get the best quality rather than having to sort through all the rubbish. You can all answer.
Well, let's start with Bernard. Yeah.
Look, that question is partly one about where are we going in terms of the revenue model, the business model for quality journalism. And we are we're in the early stages of transition, so we don't know where we're going to end up with that, because I think it's genuinely not clear that funding for quality journalism on a mass-produced basis is going to be there in the future. Now, I hope it is, but I think there's a real issue about not for specialist publications, like The Spectator maybe, or Crikey, but for mass, finding that replacement for the mass media, I think is going to be enormously difficult. But the other part of your question is one, an issue that's been around for a long time, which is, how do you filter? There's a sea of content out there. How do you filter so you don't have to spend all your time trying to work out what's quality, what's not, who can I trust? Is this quality journalism or well-informed analysis? And I think that is a role that increasingly will be one of the revenue drivers, I think, because people do want the capacity, or they do want someone to be able to actually undertake that role rather than leaving you, in effect, all at sea in an ocean of content that basically says, well, off you go and you sort through it. So that filtering role, I think, is where is going to be at least one of the probably smaller factors in driving revenues of the new media model whenever we get to it. It might be a long time. It may be decades.
Shelley?
Yeah.
Look, I think you may just hang around here, folks. Bernard, why don't you come up here and then...
I'm going to address that second half of the question that Bernard was talking about, editing and filtering. I actually spent most of my career as an editor. And one of the things, when I first came back from England, I remember Eric Beecher saying to me, editing's not treated seriously in this country. And I didn't know what he was talking about. It seemed unimaginable to me that an editor, because I'd been working in London where editors were incredibly important at every layer of the paper, because they were seen as people who got the copy in, dealt with it, checked it, made sure it got the best possible copy. It was impossible to think of a paper like the Sunday Times coming out without that level. There's layers and layers of very good editors. But he was actually right. And even today, there's often confusion about sub-editors and editors. So I would like to think that we will eventually decide that, yes, we do need these filters and editors, but it's such a hard role to describe to people. And so if you're dealing with a lot of bean counters and accountants these days, as you often are, they don't actually get why you have editors. They don't really understand. Surely there's a layer you can just leave out. And I was talking to a very senior media executive a few weeks ago who was talking in terms of, well, of course, you know, what it's going to be about in the future is we will have content that will go out this way, this way, this way, this way, this way, this way. And I said, yeah, that sounds great, but you're going to need good editors for that. And his eyes just glazed. Straight away, just glazed. So I don't know. I guess we just... I suppose the thing about Coca-Cola, you know, they always just say, you know, 100%, you know, there's 100% advertising budget and only 20% of it works, but they don't know which 20% of it. I mean, editing is just this thing that is mysterious. Tom would know all of this. Nobody ever thinks that the editor's actually ever done anything. And yet, we need them. So I don't think that really helps, Anne. But
you always have a director of a movie. You have a director of the movie.
Well, I guess maybe if we started campaigning for editors to get paid huge amounts of money, and I would really like that, and Tom would as well, then we might be treated with a bit more respect.
Tom, do you want to make a comment? Okay. Yeah. Right. So, question here. Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a...
Why don't you stand over here?
Okay, I'll stand over here.
Okay. All right.
What's the jostling for positions going on? I just wanted to make a comment. When you're talking about Q&A and about the Twitter feed that comes through, that's something I've always found quite interesting because... when you have, they sort of show, I don't know, maybe 20 or 30 over the course of the show, but over that time, they're literally getting thousands of Twitter feeds through to their site. So I was just wondering, I mean, to use your term of gatekeepers, what do you guys see for the future in relation to how they the gatekeepers can then use all the tweets that they get and only show the ones that they want to show and use those to sort of suggest, look, this is what the public opinion is, although they can actually quite skew that public opinion sense by only showing the ones that they want to show. I was just wondering if any of you guys had any thoughts.
Well, on Twitter, on this ABC's Q&A and this awful Twitter that comes at the bottom of the screen, I can talk from experience. I went on this show a few months ago, what, July, I think, and I came off air and into the makeup room and take your makeup off, and the producer said to me, "Hey, Tom, we got a great Twitter from you about you." And I said, "Oh, yeah, what was that?" And he said, "This guy deserves to be in Parliament." I went, "Fantastic, did you run it?" He goes, "Oh, no, we didn't run that." So I went home that night and I watched the replay, and yet there was a Twitter about me, and it said, "I'm cancelling my subscription to The Spectator." I think the answer to your question is it depends on who the gatekeeper is. You know, obviously, if you're more left-leaning, you're not going to like someone like me, but if you're more conservative, you would, and vice versa. So, look, the thing is, journalists can be as fair and balanced as they possibly can be, but we all have opinions, and those opinions do cloud our news judgment. Inadvertently, a lot of the time, but they do. That's one of the main problems, I think, with journalism generally, that there is... no conspiracies, but I think because most journalists, generally speaking, think alike from a sort of progressive perspective. That's why you've had this problem in the media for as long as we've had.
I just
want to say the thing about the tweets is interesting because they come in so fast. I don't know how many people are aware that there's a tradition on newspapers that when you publish your letters, they are supposed to accurately reflect the balance of the letters. And that's something that is much harder to do, obviously, on the internet with the speed.
Bernard, do you want to add to that?
I can't. I'm not a big fan of Twitter. I use it prolifically, but I don't actually get the point of why a Q&A runs to tweets. I mean, if you can sit there with your phone or your laptop, and maybe people just watch their TV. But I mean, I think a lot of the people who are actually tweeting and a lot of people watching at home are using their phone or using their laptop and making snarky comments. They don't need the Twitter feed along the bottom. And it seems to me, I don't get what the point is. What's the ABC trying to do? What's the add-on that you get with the Twitter feed? You get snarky comments from someone like me who, when I used to watch Q&A, I'd make snarky comments and occasionally they'd get on there. But it didn't add any value. And I don't really see what the ABC is really achieving.
Is it the user audience, do you reckon? Are they going for the user audience?
That may well be the case, except because the problem is that Twitter is not necessarily... particularly popular with sort of under 20, so
okay.
I don't know perhaps I have a business model
that
says.
These days I think it's under 40.
I don't make that, sorry.
Especially down the back, yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Okay, well, one of you, then you next. Yep.
A two-pronged question. Because online content is so much more accessible and cheaper, do you see online journalism killing off newspapers? And B, why do you think we've had so little buy-in from the political parties using things like Twitter and Facebook to actually as an election tool?
Well, will it kill off the mainstream media, and why are the political parties using it so rarely, is the suggestion?
It would probably kill off newspapers in the sense of the print editions, yeah, eventually. I probably already, when I answered Anne's question before, I mean, I don't think anyone knows, and look, you know, much as I may disagree with Rupert Murdoch, all power to him for searching out, trying to find that revenue model that's actually going to work, because there is nothing to replace. Those online revenues are just not enough to replace high quality journalism, I don't think. So that's a huge question mark. What was the second? Sorry.
Well, it's all about political parties.
Oh, yeah, that was the one I was actually keen to leap in on. You're right. Labor and Liberal, in particular, have been woeful at exploiting the possibilities of social media. And everyone talks about, oh, we'll learn lessons from Barack Obama's 08 campaign. And that we didn't see any evidence of that, it seemed to me, in 2010. Particularly in terms of its capacity to organise people on the ground. It was all, the idea was just to use it as a broadcast medium. Not use it as an interactive tool, not use it as an organisational tool, which is what Obama did very, very well. And I think I've argued in Crikey that this is partly because we have compulsory voting, which we're, you know, we threaten people with jail if they don't go and vote, which I find just quite remarkable, but everyone just seems to sort of wear it here. But because, I think because of that, there is just no incentive for the major parties to really be innovative in how they get the vote out. So they don't try and exploit all the tools that are available to them.
Anyone else
want to
add? Tom, do you want to add to that?
2 points. Tom, very good question. On the issue of whether new media will kill off newspapers, then I think Bernard is right, it will over time. But I think that major newspapers will adapt to these changes and themselves embrace a lot of this technology, and already they already are with respect to the websites. Tom Friedman, many of you are familiar with Tom Friedman. He's been a guest here and a well-known liberal columnist of the New York Times. He would get 20 more hits on his column twice a week. His column appears only twice a week. He gets 20 more hits than the leading left-wing blogger in the United States. That's Daily Kos. Now, what does that tell you? I think it tells you that content is still very much king. And I think brands still count. So it's a nuanced response to your first point. The second point about politics, I really would not overstate the significance of Twitter and social media in the political realm. We got a taste of that about a year ago. Kevin Rudd was, this would have been February, March, he took a big hit in the opinion polls. You may recall for the first 3 years of Kevin Rudd as opposition leader and then as Prime Minister, he was in the political stratosphere for the best part of 3 years. And he finally took a bad poll when Tony Abbott became opposition leader. Now, what did he do? He didn't go to Twitter. He didn't go to Facebook. He didn't go to FM radio. He hit the airwaves and he went on talkback radio. And he went all around Queensland and Western Australia, all those marginal seats in those swing states, and sold his agenda. He reverted to what we now know is more traditional media. And he didn't rely on Twitter to sell his case.
I just want to say one final thing about the mainstream media and the threat from the internet. I mean, yes, it is going to have a huge effect, but, I mean, it is the goose that lays the golden egg. I mean, if you look at so many websites, that content is coming from the newspapers. It's coming from where people are investing. And the editor of the New York Times has had a huge go at Arianna Stassinopoulos over the sale of the Huffington Post, because he calls her an aggregator, and a lot of that site is an aggregator. So it's going to be a very poor thing for democracy and for all of us if newspapers do go down the juice, because the online sites aren't going to pay for that kind of journalism, that kind of probing analysis.
Was somebody on the back I missed last time? Who was it? Someone try to get a question. Yeah,
it was actually more a comment than a question.
Okay, we'll take the comment. We actually take comments. We respond to comments. We welcome comments.
Well, first of all, with Twitter, I agree that there's a lot of snark online and there's a lot of snark in the blog stream. And I do find the Twitter stream, it can be nauseating, but it also facilitates an engagement with an audience that might not otherwise be interested in politics and current affairs and what's happening in our society. And I think that engagement is very important. because people are having conversations that they may not otherwise have. And I also want to make the point that there is plenty of fantastic, innovative examples where politics is being made accessible to people. There's an Open Australia initiative. This is a group of developers and hackers who publish the Hansard for everyone to view. So they're putting the Hansard up online. The government wasn't doing that. Open Australia have done that. They're doing the same thing for your council planning. You can go to planning alerts and you can get alerts from your local area and see who's building something in your street. They're doing the same thing for election leaflets, publishing all the leaflets that people submit in the current state election campaign. This is something that is adding so much transparency to politics, and I think in this debate, these sorts of great examples should also be highlighted along with the SNARC.
So defence of Twitter is engaging people. Anyone want to comment on the comment?
Look, this is not in any way, shape or form condescending, but I strongly suspect that Twitter, in the Anglosphere at least, Britain, America and Australia, is largely confined to more younger people. I don't know if many people in their 50s or older would use it.
Absolutely.
But you're not all in the 50s. You're 1920, aren't you? No, that's the only thing I'd say. I mean, maybe over time, that's right, maybe Twitter will become more of a, seen as a central legitimating idea of communications, but I do strongly suspect it's more a young person's thing. I mean, all my students, virtually all my students at university in their late teens, early 20s, use Twitter, but many of my friends, and I'm in my late 30s, will not use it.
I'm in my 30s.
Yep.
I use Twitter.
Yep.
So, anyway.
Yeah, sure.
I think it is a medium for 30-pluses, but... another thing to mention.
Hang on, we got an encouraging comment, but not too many.
I'll blog about it.
Well, finish your point.
Twitter is a mechanism where, of course, you can control your feed, but with Q&A, there's a handle. So with Hurricane Katrina, there's a handle. With, Heart Japan at the moment, there's a handle. So people can be exposed to a wider topic area by certain mechanisms within the technology. It's also important to know.
Right, so, okay. Mm-hmm. All right, so there's a question here. Yeah.
You were speaking of the internet and its importance, as well as interconnectedness. Have you got any comments about using the internet in starting revolutions as exemplified in Libya and, of course, Egypt, and the involvement of the media with the general public? Because in Russia, apparently, at least two or three journalists were assassinated, inverted commas. So what's your opinion about using the internet for starting a revolution in different countries?
I have very strong opinions about that. There's been an enormous debate, mainly amongst US commentators, about the significance of Facebook and Twitter and blogs in what's been happening in the Middle East. Opponents saying, look, revolutions happened before, we didn't need Twitter for the French Revolution. Proponents saying, they were crucial in playing a role. Some people throw WikiLeaks into the mix, particularly in Tunisia and Egypt. I think that debate gets hung up on what I mentioned during my speech, which is an obsession with the technologies and the platforms, rather than concentrating on what they enable, which is the connectedness between people. I think that's the key, not so much the technology itself or the applications. People will use what they can to connect together and share ideas. I can't remember the academic, the US academic made a very good point about the one different aspect of new media in these revolutions was, she said, it solves the prisoner's dilemma of living in a repressive society, which is you don't know who else shares your view that it's time to overthrow the regime. But that's solved when you get when you can get online and actually see who else feels that way, how many tens of thousands of people feel that way. Of course, the opponents come back and say, well, regimes can see exactly what's happening and can target individuals and get stuck into them. And that is true as well. But it, you know, it comes back to interconnectedness and facilitating that rather than being focused too much on individual applications.
Do you want to add to that?
I was just thinking that...
I'm really going to make way for Tom,
but that idea of... it's pretty terrifying, the idea that you would be under a repressive regime. You really got to be careful of which friends were sending you Twitter, wouldn't you? You really would be thinking, no, don't send it, delete it. You know, very dangerous. Yeah, Tom.
I think you're right. You're onto something. I mean, all the available evidence indicates that Twitter and social media, the internet, have played a role in the uprisings in Tunisia and certainly in Egypt. It's not altogether clear how things will pan out in Libya. But bear in mind, about 18 months ago, we had the so-called Twitter revolution in where? Iran. And, you know, a lot of young dissidents who were rebelling against the system, Ahmadinejad and the regime, used Twitter. And it's not altogether clear what's happened to a lot of those young people who did use Twitter. So I think Twitter can be a double-edged sword in some of these countries.
They're stirring some China, apparently.
Through Twitter?
Yeah.
Okay.
Apparently. Okay, so question,
then?
Yeah.
Mine's a hypothesis. And it is that... a majority of the controversies on the blogosphere, or the, perhaps not Twitter, but the blogosphere broadly, only get seen by a mass audience after attention has been drawn to them by the traditional media.
Well, gentlemen, I want to respond to the suggestion that material on the blogosphere only comes up, essentially comes from the mainstream traditional media. Any response to that, Vern?
Yes, I'm speaking too much. Yes, true. This probably doesn't quite answer your question, but I think that one of the elements in that issue is what proportion of people are we actually talking about who are genuinely engaged in, if we want to, let's just confine it to political debate, what proportion of the population are genuinely engaged in sort of thinking about politics? What, you know, how many people wake up on a Sunday morning and watch Insiders? How many people regularly tune into the 7:30 report? Always, I think, increasingly a very small proportion of the population. I mean, that's why you don't see political interviews on the tabloid current affairs programs anymore. 20 years ago, you'd see Paul Keating on being interviewed on Today Tonight. That doesn't happen anymore. It happens very, very rarely. Because there's been this sort of switch-off of political debate. And going beyond that, the number of people using... new media to access politics is probably a subset of that, although a fairly significant proportion. So you're dealing with, I think in both cases, a relatively small proportion of the population who are already sort of switched on to politics. My theory is that the only time a large mass of the population actually chooses into political issues is on those rare occasions when you know there's a really big story. Malcolm Turnbull and Goblin Gretch. For example, where they just suddenly tune in, it's no longer just the 30 seconds they get on the evening news, they actually focus. And that creates those rare political moments which are there to be won or lost for politicians. The rest of the time, I don't think there's very much engagement.
Anyone want to add to that? Okay, well, we're getting near the end now. No, okay, so Harold, we don't have a lot of time now, yeah?
I don't know what to answer this, but do you think the way it's going, defamation will almost disappear with this? Electronic media.
Question about defamation in the electronic media, in the electronic era. Anyone want to talk about defamation?
In a word, no. I don't think, no. People will still sue for defamation, and successfully.
Sorry.
The answer was people will still sue for defamation and successfully.
I mean, the days of the internet being a sort of a wild west, where you can say anything and get away with it, long, long gone. It's very hard. And the days of people being anonymous on the internet are drawing to a close too. Certainly in Western countries. In short, no.
Okay, we're getting very close to the end of the question here.
This is not a question or a comment, really, but a plea. And it's a plea for more blogs of the quality and humour of Shelley Gale's recent blog about... I think it's about men not listening to women. And a plea for members here to forward it to all their mates.
We're not even related. Thank you very much.
Well, Shelley Gere's blog goes out... What? Called Hello goes up on the Sydney Institute website about once every 3 weeks.
It's going to go every 2 weeks, yeah.
It's going to be every 2 weeks. And there's someone made a very kind comment on it, for which... we'll pay you later.
She has to work, huh?
So I think we've pretty well concluded. What's your own future on all this? I mean, what are you up for? I mean, Shelley Gere we know about. She's up on the Sydney Institute, so you can't get better than that. Bernard, you're wedged into crikey?
I wouldn't use the word wedged, but a verb similar to that one is probably...
And Tom?
Well, my wife's just given birth, so I'm worried about how soon my daughter will be twittering.
Congratulations.
Okay, look, I think that's a great place to leave it. We've had three excellent papers, and they'll be great when they're published, and they're up on our podcast either tomorrow or Thursday. And then we've had a terrific discussion, for which thanks to our speakers, but also to all of you in the audience who asked questions, made comments and entered pleas. So it was a wide distribution. So many thanks to Tom Switzer, Shelley Gere and Bernard Keane for a great night tonight. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.